Hey, this is Tony from the Backseat Producers.
And this is Adam from the Backseat Producers and the podcast.
And I should say that I'll probably be doing Tony's Losing It again really soon, maybe by the time this is released. What we've got here is an interview
with an IP lawyer from Hush Blackwell Sanders about copyright law and characters.
This guy is a comic book lawyer.
Yep.
This dude protects superheroes.
He does.
Sort of. And you can check out Jeff's blog at iplitigator.hushblackwell.com. And Hush is spelled H-U-S-C-H. So that's iplitigator.hushblackwell.com. And there will be a link in the show notes for that. Take a listen, and if you like what you hear, come check out our other podcasts. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Adam.
And this is Phil.
Want to introduce yourself?
I'm Jeff Gerber, and I'm a comic book lawyer.
That's awesome.
That's a cool title.
That is awesome.
If I knew that was an option when I was in school, I would have studied a lot harder.
Is that actually on your business card, comic book lawyer?
Because no,
it should
I
be.
Wish.
It should be. You should I have. Wish. You should get a T-shirt that you always wear under your suit. And you just, boom, comic book lawyer.
Or something that, like, I protect the superheroes.
That's awesome.
Yes.
That would be very cool.
Yeah, the superheroes just aren't tough enough.
Yeah.
They need somebody a little bit more mean.
Yeah.
When I was going around Comic-Con, I guess a year and a half ago, I was going around, I'd talk to people, and it'd come up, and, oh, got a card? And I was always, like, scribbling on the back of it, why the heck are they getting a lawyer's card here? Because this is what I do.
Sure.
I do a little bit of comic book law. Scribbling my blog on there.
Nice.
Saying,
nice.
Yeah, check this out.
Well, go ahead and advertise your blog right now. We'll get it out there, and we'll make sure it's linked, if that's all right.
Yeah, it's actually going through a rebranding right now, so the stuff is
a little
bit stale, but it's Owners, Borrowers, and Thieves 2.0.
Okay.
It's a blog I do with some of my partners at the law firm about intellectual property issues, about authorized use and how to protect creative property. And most of what I focus on there is fair use issues and comic books. And
nice.
It is at, I think we're at iplitigator.com right now.
Okay.
Okay. I think
you know, we'll verify that, and we'll make sure that it gets in the show notes for the episode so it's linked so people can go right to it if they need to.
Yeah. I know there's a link off my bio on the law firm page, hushblackwellsanders.com. So.
All right.
Yeah, I'll find it. And if I can't, I'll just have Melina find it for me.
well, I guess one of the questions I had, just to start things off, I'm a writer. I've done some working on anthologies. One of the anthologies that I worked on, there was a character that was the central theme of the anthology. So you had a number of writers who wrote this character, and it was presented for the first time in publication in this book. How would something like that be handled in terms of copyright and who owns the copyright? There was one person who came up with a concept for the anthology, but primarily their work does not appear in the anthology. So,
sure. For me, character copyright is probably the most interesting area of copyright law, because everybody's interested in how you go about registering a copyright, and it's very simple. You simply fill out usually about a one-page form, attach a copy of the original work to the form, send it in, a little bit of money, and boom, a couple weeks later, your registration comes back and you're registered.
Mm-hmm.
If you tried to do that with a character, say, here's my character, and send it in, they'd send it back to you and say, no registration, because there is no way to register a character. There's no original work called a character.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You can have a short story. You can have a play, a script. You could have a movie. You could have any number of original works of authorship. But none of those are a character. However, over time, the courts have recognized that characters have a sort of special place within copyright, mm-hmm. in that if they are sufficiently delineated, they have a life of their own. You would certainly expect that a character is going to act consistent with that character's mm-hmm. internal motivation based upon their background. So if somebody takes a character and places it from one location to another location or one situation to another situation, it can be a very different work, but the character is going to be viewed as having been copied. So character copyright is a different thing, and I'll talk about it some tomorrow morning in the context of a bunch of specific cases.
Mm-hmm.
But it all goes to get copyright protection, it all goes back to that original work of authorship fixed in a tangible medium. And so when you were working on this anthology, the person that developed the character, you said created the concept for a character.
Right.
As I discussed earlier tonight, you can't copyright an idea. So when they develop that concept, if they sit down and talk with all the other writers, they're just chatting and nobody's recording anything, and he said, this is how I view the character. There's no copyright there. He has no authorship in the character, despite having come up with the idea.
Mm-hmm.
However, if he develops a backstory for the character and writes up a 6-page storyline description of the character, describes the looks of the character, where the character is from, the character gives a name to the character, describes the character's appearance, talks about the character's background and the character's tendencies, if they have any particular habits, then the character starts to get fleshed out. Putting all of those things down on paper creates an original work of authorship, and that work gets copyright protection. Okay. So when you sue to protect a character, you sue based on the original work, not based on the character, but the character itself will give you a little bit of a broader protection than just the work itself would have given you.
Okay.
And I can go on, you know, much longer without any questions intervening whatsoever.
Sure.
But, I don't know what happened with that anthology and how the character was given to the people who were going to then work on it.
Yeah, it was, and in this specific case, it was an online community. So it was an email that was sent out saying, here are the guidelines. He actually had someone do drawings of the character based on his descriptions. And a lot of this was formed before the anthology began. Then he said, okay, here are your guidelines for using the character. Here's, it was kind of a selection process. And it was almost like a contest, and the worthy entries would be published in the anthology. A question that I have kind of stemming off of that, his character was one of the characters in my story. Now, my story also had other characters that didn't appear anywhere else. They weren't described in any of his material. It was characters that I created solely to have a story around this one character. How would those characters be handled in terms of like character copyright?
Well, when you create your work of authorship, mm-hmm. your story, you are the author, and you have the copyright in that story. He gave you a license, an oral license, to use the character, to use the content that he and others had created in your story, and so that was authorized use. Your story, if it was based around that character, would be using that character, using copyrighted work from somewhere else, becomes what's called a derivative work.
Okay.
And the original owner continues to hold a copyright in what they did, mm-hmm. and they can claim some ownership in the derivative, some rights in the derivative. But the person who creates the derivative, you, the mm-hmm. author of that story that used that character, you are the author and hold the sole copyright in all the original elements of the story that you wrote, despite the fact that you used his character.
Okay.
So every other character that you create in there is yours. I mean, that's your copyright material, your copyright character. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier, that he actually had somebody do some drawings. In determining whether or not a character is sufficiently delineated or defined to get copyright protection, one of the things that courts look at is whether or not there's an image of the character. And so if you go around out there, lots of people write a novel, and they'll have a very lifelike character in there, but that character isn't necessarily going to be entitled to independent copyright protection apart from that story, because there's not an image that goes with it. And that may be very unfair, and you may be able to get around it. There are characters that have been recognized in copyright that appear first in novels, such as James Bond.
Okay.
James Bond is a character for which the courts have recognized a copyright. But at the time that they recognized it, the character had also appeared in a bunch of movies, but it had been defined and delineated over a number of years through a series of works of authorship. And James Bond as a character has very specific things, you know, Bond, James Bond, shaken, not stirred. He has a penchant for formal wear, things like that, that feed to an image and an identity that's easy to pick up on. Back in the first half of the century, one of the most famous judges this country's had, Judge Learned Hand, greatest name, I think, of all time for a judge.
That is awesome.
And his brother was Justice, I think, Justice Hand.
Nice.
Another judge.
Wow. Nice.
But
talk about superhero names.
Yeah, no kidding.
Fantastic names. But Judge Hand, he wrote an opinion where he harkens back to Shakespeare and describes what's copyrightable and what's not about characters in Shakespeare by way of example, talking about Twelfth Night and Sir Toby Belch in Twelfth Night, who loved to go around and drink, you know, and he was raucous. And okay, now, that doesn't mean that somebody can't go out and put a character just like that. But when you got to start adding things on that define it, a name, a location, a place and time, and is that alone going to be enough? Well, if somebody goes out and uses name Sir Toby Belch in a particular location, place and time about a nobleman who likes to get drunk and carouse and wassail, as Judge Hand chose to say. You know, is that enough to define it, or do you need more? Do you need a look? Do you need to know if he has blonde hair or brown hair? Do you need to know if he has a scar? So there are different things, and it makes it all very complicated when you try to decide what's copyrightable and what's not. We mentioned earlier tonight the Superman litigation, the most recent decision in that case about Superman. There was a lot of back and forth on what elements were contributed when and what elements, you know, made the character. When was the character defined enough to be copyrightable? You know, at one point in time, because DC Comics, the last decision said DC Comics has the copyright in the pre-publication solicitation advertisement that went out.
Okay.
And it was a reduced image, reduced size, black and white image of the cover of issue one of Action Comics.
All right.
It was black and white. So DC Comics has that, but Jerry Siegel has issue one itself.
Okay.
One of the big differences was color was added. So if DC Comics previously had this guy in a cape and tights and a leotard, you know, okay, but he didn't have, and he had picking up and throwing a car, but it didn't have him running faster than a train. It didn't have bullets bouncing off of him. It didn't have him leaping over a building, all of which issue one had. And it didn't have blue and red Mm-hmm. And the triangle, inverted triangle logo was not yellow and red. It was not gold and red. So those were things that, that were in Siegel's copyright.
Okay. In that instance, then, as if... see how I'm going to phrase this. Since they kind of added to that character as he went on, he became more defined. If at the point that he was defined enough, would that be where the point of copyright would then lie? You know, when he, you know, and now all of a sudden he's not just leaping, he's flying, and they're showing bullets bouncing off his chest, and I'm trying to think of more because I know how much was in Action Comics number one, and there was a lot in there.
There was a lot in there, but
that defined him.
It issue one didn't say that it came from Krypton.
Okay.
And you didn't know that kryptonite was a weakness. He could leap a building. He could leap an eighth of a mile.
Right.
But he couldn't fly.
Yeah.
What are some of the many other things? You knew that he was Clark Kent and Superman. And they started to establish the romantic triangle between Lois Lane and the alter egos.
Right.
One of the most bizarre triangles ever when there are only
the
two people.
The two-sided triangle, yeah.
You know, so they'd started to establish that, but certain events had certainly not happened. He did not, in that one, he did not have heat vision. He did not have telescopic vision or super hearing.
Right.
You know, there are powers that he acquired as time went on through the course of it that add to who he is.
Well, and they've changed also the character from how he existed then to how he exists now. I know in the early ones, he had his powers from infancy, and now they developed somewhere later in his teen years, things like that. Does that change the picture at all?
It changes it, and it's got to change when you have hundreds, and by now, I mean, we must be talking thousands of issues.
Oh, yeah, it's in the thousands.
Plus retcons. Oh,
that's what I was wondering.
You got a retcon. You got
DC
multiple universes.
That, yeah, all the time.
So the different Marvel. Like yeah, and then you've got Smallville
right.
Derivative works like that completely negate the
sure
the previous like the Superboy
yeah
stuff.
Yeah, and well, and it's interesting because the Superman litigation going on out in California, there are two lawsuits that Siegel's heirs brought. One was over Superman, and the other was over Superboy. And they're going on at the same time
right
in front of the same judge. And one of the big issues that was decided, it was 2007, and I want to say it was maybe July of 07, was whether or not Superboy was a separate character. And the decision was that Superboy is an independently copyrightable, but it is a derivative character.
Okay. Right.
Mm-hmm. So Superboy and Superman are the same character.
Right.
But they're different.
Right. They're related, but different.
They're the same individual at different points in time in their life, in different circumstances and situations.
Yes.
I'm involved in. Representing a client, Todd McFarlane, in some ongoing litigation with Neil Gaiman over a character called Miracle Man.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have a lot of very similar issues going on. One of a different lawsuit between Todd and Neil involved a couple of characters, three characters in particular, that first appeared in issue 9 of Spawn. And I think that case helps to explain it and helps to confuse it at the same time. Because up until that point in time, you looked at the stuff and you're like, okay, the character gets copyright protection. It can be copyrightable when it's sufficiently defined.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And the court's going to tell us when that is. There were the three characters at issue coming out of issue 9 in that lawsuit were a character called Angela,
mm-hmm.
an angel huntress, a character called Medieval Spawn, who was a hell spawn former leader of Satan's army from the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. and a character called Cagliostro. And Cagliostro, at the time, was a character that was going to be. He first appeared in issue number 9, but he was going to be something a little bit like Alfred in Batman. He was going to be a character to move the plot along, to help provide some explanation. He was going to be a plot device. And medieval Spawn was very much like Spawn, set in a different time period. Mm-hmm. It was a different individual. And we learned a few things about him. The costume was very similar, but a little bit different. And the court, Judge Posner of the Seventh Circuit, when he issued a decision, the case is still going on, but he wrote an opinion that was, we call interlocutory, an intermediate opinion about these characters, and he said that medieval Spawn was a derivative character.
Okay.
Spawn was a character. Medieval Spawn comes out of Spawn. There are some original elements that give it some original protection in and of itself, but it is a derivative character.
Okay.
And so it's understandable that was protected, even though Medieval Spawn was in 6 pages of a comic.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Angela was in and out of the entire comic.
Mm-hmm.
There was never really any contest about whether or not she would be copyrightable after that comic. Cagliostro appeared in very, very little. The script that Neil wrote for him probably all told doesn't take up much more than a half page. If I went back and looked at the opinion, I could tell you exactly.
Sure.
I think the court quoted the entire portion of the script.
Wow.
About Cagliostro. And his name was different.
Mm.
Neil Gaiman names him Cagliostro with an A.
Mm-hmm.
Has just a few lines of dialogue. He's somewhat mysterious. He's a street bum in the alleys, and all he does really is ask Spawn to create some wine for him to drink out of thin air. He appears to then somehow know that Spawn has special powers and knows something about what Spawn needs to do in order to use them to make the wine.
Right.
And then he goes off. And that's about it. Then you tie in the picture that Todd drew, you know,
right.
He's a bum in an overcoat with a long white beard.
Mm-hmm.
And going into this, the argument was, well, he's not sufficiently defined. And many, many issues later, you learn that his name's Cagliostro and that he was a former Hellspawn who figured out how to conserve his power so he could stay on Earth.
Right.
And you learn all sorts of different things about this character.
I remember all that.
None of that
I was reading all of those.
None of that was in that issue. But Judge Posner said what was in there is enough. So I think that decision has really dropped the bar as to what's required in order to give copyright protection to a character.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's going to be just, you know, you're also going to have the storyline with it, or if you took Cagliostro and spun him off into his own story at that point in time, you know, whether you'd end up with a different result. But Judge Posner said just that little bit's going to be enough. Now what happens is that the character evolves, and somebody other than Neil and somebody other than Todd go out and they write another issue,
mm-hmm.
and they put Cagliostro in there, and you learn more about him. Right? That next issue is a derivative work of issue number 9.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a derivative work probably of issue number 1 of Spawn and 2 and of 3, and it builds upon that.
Right.
And what the people that create that later on down the line, what they own is the original elements of it that they have minus everything that was written before it. That case between Neil and Todd right now is tied up waiting for an accounting to resolve how, and one of the issues that's going to need to be resolved is once you figure out how many profits are attributable to each of those comics, how do you decide
holy
how
cow.
To allocate the shares from issue number 98 with Cagliostro appearing on three pages?
Yeah.
How much of the profits from that book go back to Neil and Todd and get split? Go back to Neil and Todd from issue number 9 and get split. And so, you know, but that case has been going on for, since 2000, 2001?
I've got a background in mathematics, and my head just started throbbing just at the concept of the mathematics and the accounting that must be involved in something like that.
For me, it seems almost a moot point at that point because the accounting cost and the legal fees, I mean, probably not, but I mean, just thinking about how to split this up, at the end, you're probably going to be spending more than figuring out what to split it up at.
Well, you know, once we finish litigating that out and have a decision from the court, I'd be happy to come back and talk to you guys about it.
That would be very cool. Awesome. Yeah. Now, kind of branching out, still kind of carrying on this topic, does the character copyright protection, is this the length of that protection, is that still the same as like a copyrighted work? How does that work?
If you remember, the copyright registration is actually in the work fixed in the tangible medium. So you're going to go back to the issue of the comic.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so that copyright's going to run with that work, not with the character.
Okay.
Okay. Now, what's going to happen, and you can see it in the example of The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Right. Frank Baum, what he wrote has dumped into the public domain. And so those characters, as he's created them, are already in the public domain because that work is in the public domain.
Right.
So anybody can go out, and they do. And when I was at Comic-Con going around, there were a number of various folks on the floor who had developed and were selling something somehow based on The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
And there were Dorothy things and more Dorothy things and a Woodman, you know, Tin Woodman here. And so they're doing this based on The Wizard of Oz, on Baum's, but the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's property is still in copyright protection. And so what they have protected is the original elements that they added. And so if you what you would need to do to find out how long the protection is going to last is you have to take Frank Baum's novel and you'd have to kind of outline those two characters, and you'd start deleting from the outline from the MGM movie of Dorothy, and let's say it's Dorothy in a blue and white checkerboard dress with shoulder straps and a dog named Toto. The dress went down, you know, I can't remember, to just below her knees or whatever.
Right.
And she had particular color eyes, etc. Well, then she did this and she did that. Then you go back to Baum's work and you say, okay, he had a character named Dorothy. Okay, well, Dorothy's no longer protected. So that's open and fair game.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In his work, Dorothy had braided pigtails. So those are still – in his work, Dorothy had a blue and white checkerboard. And I don't remember because it's been forever since I've –
But
maybe in his work – the dress didn't necessarily have the straps like a jumper over the shoulders.
Right.
Maybe that wasn't specifically in there. So the straps on the shoulders are an original element of expression of what Dorothy would look like.
Sure.
That MGM adds, and so MGM still has protection of that. And if you go out and you try and do that, then you're going to be in trouble.
So then, like for example, going back to Superman. in the future when Action Comic number one falls into the public domain, you can have a character named Superman that has super strength and he can leap over a building. But you couldn't necessarily include the elements of Kryptonite and Lex Luthor until the works that created those elements
fall into the public domain.
Okay.
Yeah. And Superman is unique. Superman is unique, and you can argue Marvel versus DC and Superman versus Batman, another character. But Superman's unique in part because he was the first major superhero character to appear in the funny pages with science fiction-like superpowers and took off in a way. And he's unique because national publications sued like crazy and went in front of a bunch of stodgy judges who weren't reading the funny pages, or at least weren't reading these comics that the kids were reading, and said, oh my gosh, that infringes. Because one of the first things that happened in superhero comics was Superman beat Captain Marvel. National Publications sues, was it Brune in that one? Fawcett? Fawcett, I guess.
Fawcett, yeah.
And over Captain Marvel, and I'll talk about that tomorrow, so I'll make sure I have the case name right. But, you know, sues and wins because they look at it and they say, super strength, the ability to hold a car over your head, and starts going through the elements. And all of a sudden, a guy in a cape who can do all these different things, even though he has a different name, different color, you know, lots of different expressive elements, there's an infringement. And this is in the early days when they're developing character copyright concept. And so, but what it did was it forced Captain Marvel out of existence.
Right.
They settled for $400,000 and had to stop writing Captain Marvel. So he disappeared for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And what it really led to was Marvel Man, which then led to Miracle Man, which, you know, I mean, that litigation is still going on.
Right.
But Superman gets this unparalleled breadth of protection that no other character today would ever get.
Right.
You would have to show a much closer expression, I think, to say that you were infringing. It doesn't share the same name, doesn't share the same origin story, you know.
Right.
I've got a question. Now, usually the stuff that you've been talking about is, you know, like the person that drew, you know, for Action Comics, you know, on Superman, what his thing is. For example, the movie, The Wizard of Oz, MGM has that. And then, of course, but the book is open, you know, that was what the person's life plus or from death 70 years.
Yeah.
What is, say, because MGM, I mean, is it basically when they go out of, you know, when that company dies, then 70 years it becomes, or I mean, is it the same when it's a company?
No, it's not. And for the years, I always have to go back and look and double check. But for the company to be considered the author, I mean, Here's the deal. An author is normally a person,
right?
Right? Things are only created by humans in this regard. So far, given advances in science, you know, we'll
and we
see
are
at
a
goes.
Science fiction convention, so that's appropriate to talk about.
We'll be constructing bears in no time.
But right now, humans are creating copyrighted works. So some human out there was directing the movie. Okay. Some human wrote it. You know, it was done under license, but some human wrote it. And I don't know the details of MGM's arrangement, but most likely the folks that did that were employed, and it was done as a work for hire, a little bit of what I'll talk about tomorrow. There's a great comic book case. Marv Wolfman sued Marvel over, among other things, Blade. And ownership of the character Blade,
right.
Deacon Frost. And a lot of that turned on work for hire. And And so work for hire means that if you're an employee, when you create something as an employee, the author is your employer.
Right.
So MGM then becomes the author. So you have a corporate entity that is not going to die.
Right.
So the law says that in the case of a work for hire, it is going to be, and there's a circumstance where it's 90 years.
Okay.
That
would be the Walt Disney thing?
125. Yeah, yeah. And, well, and actually, I'm not, I'd have to go back and double check. I'm sure that there's a Wikipedia entry on, yeah. on the Mickey Mouse
there's
clause.
There's Wikipedia entries on everything.
And not that you should go and rely on it, but it'd give a good...
You know what Wikipedia told me once? That Hillary Clinton was the president for 10 years, starting, like, 5 years from now. I'm just saying. Wikipedia told me that.
I've used Wikipedia to win arguments.
It's
just go in and change it to whatever you said. I've done it.
That's a nice way to go about it. Eh?
Hey, my point's on Wikipedia.
It's on Wikipedia. courts have kind of caught on to that. There are a few courts that have said Wikipedia is not authoritative.
That's
good.
Hopefully that wasn't a long-time decision that needed to be made.
Shockingly, it took long enough to do some damage.
Wow. That's not good.
Yeah, that's kind of sad.
But I don't remember which it is because which part of the clause Disney has had the most influence on because I don't know that Disney as a corporation existed when Walt Disney drew Steamboat Willie.
Oh, okay.
Right. So I mean, if he wasn't already a corporation when he was doing that, then what you're doing is you're talking about life plus 70.
Oh, okay.
When that date is figured, like they come up with the date for it, right? So there's 100 issues of the comic that run, I don't know, weekly, whatever.
Usually monthly.
Monthly. That's over the span of 100 months. That's some odd years. What date do they use for that? Is it the start or is it the end?
The termination date on mm-hmm. copyright when it dumps into public domain is the end of the year.
Okay.
So the question is what year was it created?
Okay. So it goes
at least, you know, there. And I might, you know, if I were concerned, I'd have to, like a good lawyer, I would throw out all my disclaimers and I would run to the books and double check. And the reason for that being that we've had multiple copyright acts.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
one of the big things with Superman and Superboy has been that for most of their existence they were governed by the 1909 Copyright Act, which provided for periods of copyright renewal
right.
and case law that said, you know, when you assign your right, you can also assign your renewal right.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't so great for a lot of creators. And the 1976 Act changed some of the ways that those things are done and provided for a termination right, which doesn't run from the end of the year, but instead runs from the exact date of publication and is very mm-hmm. highly technical. But there's a window of opportunity after 61 years or at about 61 years that you can provide notice of termination of an assignment. So when I say that Walt Disney was drawing Steamboat Willie, if he did that as an individual, how does it get to be owned by Disney? Well, Walt then assigns that in a written document to Disney to own, hold, and control. The way it works is if you assign that to somebody, to a company, the way the Copyright Act is written now, there is a window of time, and that's why I'm saying about 61 years, because I know 61 years is one of the dates, but I always have to go back and double-check the statute. Don't ever, whoever's out there, never rely on anybody answering off the cuff about termination issues. It is one of the most arcane, complicated things to do, and if you're worried, if you don't believe me, read the Superman decision where they talk about all the screw-ups and how, I think I mentioned earlier, the advertisement.
Yes.
Because the termination notice didn't specify the right window of time. They missed out on claiming copyright ownership, recovering copyright ownership in those advertisements by like 10 days.
Wow, that's crazy.
So there's an assignment, and now there's a termination. Mm-hmm. There's a window of time in which the owner can say, you know what, I know I assigned that to you decades ago, but not so much anymore. I want it back.
Sure.
And the idea being that you could, you know, be a young starving artist and create something totally cool, but you know, you need to feed yourself and your family, and so you sell it, you sign it away,
right?
And you know, 20 years later, somebody's making a mint off that thing because they knew how to leverage it and they had the money to do it.
Which I know is a lot of issues with early comic book artists and writers. That there are a lot of them that basically were destitute, and because they were starving artists and writers, and they needed money, and everything that they created that now is an amazingly valuable property, they did it work for hire because that was their option.
And possibly most famously, the Siegel and Shuster,
right,
with respect to Superman. And you've got the Penn-winning novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay,
right,
that fictionalizes that story.
Mm-hmm.
In a tremendous book, and talks about just how that can happen.
I think I'm all out of questions.
I wonder how many books do you have to reference on something when you go into a case?
Wow. You know,
just because, like, you're saying, you know, well, in this case, blah, 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 and I'm like, I would hate to be the person that has to research these things, because, I mean, how do you... It's just mind-boggling, actually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are at least 300 reported cases involving comics. You know, it's hard to keep them all straight in your head, but that's just a fraction of copyright and trademark law and right of publicity law. And, you know, when I go out and I reference something, I mean, we store libraries on the computer, and so we're searching through thousands of volumes for cases, and... you got to learn to read fast. You got to try and remember things, and hopefully learn your research skills well.
I have a question. I don't know if how much you know about it. One of the things that I always was curious about was how Marvel and DC were able to trademark the two words superheroes when it. In my mind, I mean, basically because I think I've pretty much grew up knowing those terms for all superheroes. I think that was about when they trademarked it in the early 70s.
I think there may have been a few applications in the 60s. There were like superhero kids,
right,
and a few things.
Because that one's always kind of baffled me that, I mean... In my mind, it's such a generic term, but it's obviously not legally.
Well, I don't represent either of those two companies, and I will tell you, I wonder the same thing from time to time, but most importantly, I wonder how Marvel can have a trademark in superhero, and how DC can have a trademark in superhero when trademarks are intended to be a designation of source of origin, and if both of them are using superhero to designate that they are the source for anything in comics that bears the name superhero, how can that possibly be? How can those two exist simultaneously? And some of it has to do with the fact that if you go back and you look at the registrations, they are not straightforward registrations that cover all comics. They are not just superhero, and the two registrations are slightly different. And, you know, I have not yet found a case in which they've been able to enjoin somebody from using the term superhero. There could easily be one out there, but you know, depending how you use it, that's, you know, if you use it as an adjective, you're not using it as a trademark. You know, if you say, wow, that guy's just like a superhero. And if you write that in a comic book, you know, you're using it in a descriptive way, not in a trademark way. So, you know, you can...
Was it? There was a comic book, and I can't remember the name of it now, that had superhero in the title, and it was like superhero something. And it was in the title. And
that's where you would get a lawsuit.
If I remember, I think all they needed to get was a cease and desist, and I think that was probably enough, because it was a small press.
Yeah. I mean, would you really want to take them on?
It's not worth it.
Only if I had deep enough pockets to get that, to warrant that much publicity. I wouldn't want to.
Well, something like that, because in your presentation today, you mentioned something like Xerox and how everybody was saying, make a Xerox of this. When does, and I don't know if it can happen, but when does a name like that literally become, from one of those levels, too generic, or can it?
No, it can. And
that's how I see the word superhero. It's become generic.
Well, I think if you looked it up in Webster's New World Dictionary, the fourth, or whichever version Justice Scalia uses at the Supreme Court, and you looked in there and there was a definition for superhero, at that point in time, as long as you use that word as it's defined, it's a generic term, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Once it's in dictionaries, you know, we're talking about Wikipedia. If somebody has I haven't gone and checked it, so they may already have it. If somebody goes out and has a Wikipedia site for a superhero and talks about what a superhero is and goes about defining a superhero, there's an encyclopedia entry, and superhero defines a range of things that includes not just DC or not just Marvel characters or comics, but, you know, it becomes to define a particular type of action hero, then it's generic. If that's the way...
Sure.
Now, what happens in the law world when you go to court is that one side is going to come in with their dictionary entries and the other side's going to come in and show all the ways in which people don't use it in a dictionary sense, and... you know, and you're going to fight it out and try to get a ruling. And there are a number of cases out there where terms have become generic, and we talk about it as genericide.
Genericide.
So that's literally where Kleenex or Xerox can become a generic term.
Yes, and Xerox is a great example of a company that brought their mark back from the brink of death.
If, say, for example, Xerox was to go generic, is there a way that they could... I mean, if it can go one way, can it go back the other way?
It can go back the other way, and in just that way, they go out and they do an advertising campaign, and they convince people through advertising, but they would have to prove that no longer in the mind of the public does Xerox mean a photocopy, and the two are interchangeable, but that the public now recognizes that, and you would probably do it through surveys. Most likely, you'd have a war of experts. They come in and they go out and they run focus groups and they do surveys in malls and they do this stuff that they do where they ask people a question and they'll ask them a bunch of different things and they'll try and hide what they're really trying to get at and then come out and they'll interpret the results and they'll say 95% of people believe that Xerox means photocopier or photocopy goods that are produced by a particular company called Xerox. And if they have survey results like that, they can bring it back out. It's called secondary meaning.
Oh.
We have terms for everything.
Yes, I know. I hope Melina study for her exams. Yes, it's awful. I got nothing here.
I'm done. Unless you have anything that you'd like to add to...
I'm just anything shocked you were willing to listen to a lawyer for that long.
I'm married to one. I have to. Yeah. So
you too.
Yeah.
We got to find you one.
Oh, no, I'm good.
All right.
I used to work for a law firm. Well, not in your sense, but I was the IT guy for and they would tell me their stories, and I'd be like, But they were medical malpractice.
They weren't comic book lawyers.
Comic book lawyers.
How cool!
You
is
get
that?
Cool points for that.
Yeah.
I can still remember the day you gave the presentation. Emelina's like, there was an IP lawyer, and he did a talk about comic book law, and I was like, wow. Okay.
It does exist.
I had to go up to and talk to him after he did the presentation. I'm like, cool.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to me.
Well, thank you for coming on and talking to us. We really appreciate it. And yeah, we'd love to have you on again sometime.
Sure.
Maybe after another ruling that we can talk about stuff. I find this stuff interesting. I don't know how much anybody else does, but I think this stuff is very cool. I really get into it.
Find out whether or not you guys get flamed.
Hey.
We'll be the first time.
Yeah. No big deal there. Yeah.
All right, cool.